times, and I say it to the press, I say it to anybody that wants to listen. I think that your country has tremendous economic potential.
Hello, welcome to Plugged In. I'm Greta Van Susteren. In the wake of broken negotiations in Hanoi, Vietnam, between the United States President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, what's the future? More discussions or dead end? Both nations giving very different reasons why those talks abruptly broke down. Meanwhile, back in Washington, President Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, giving damning testimony before Congress about his involvement in the Trump business, the Trump campaign, and Trump administration. But will Michael Cohen's testimony have any impact on the Mueller investigation? And what will his testimony mean, if anything, for the Trump presidency? Former U.N. Ambassador and New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson is here to give us his firsthand opinion on the art of negotiating with foreign nations, especially with North Korea, where he has traveled multiple times. And we will be joined by our VOA correspondents who have been closely covering both these stories. We begin with a summit that the whole world watched, and which President Donald Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un unexpectedly cut short. The reason, according to President Trump, was that Chairman Kim asked for too much. And VOA's Bill Gallo reports, the big question is, where, if any place, the negotiations go from here?
Donald Trump portrays himself as a dealmaker. But in Hanoi with Kim Jong-un, he couldn't reach a deal.
I could have signed an agreement today, and then you people would have said, oh, what a terrible deal, what a terrible thing he did. Now, you'll have to be prepared to walk.
Trump had been lowering expectations for days, saying there is no rush to reach a deal. Turns out he was right. Kim demanded all sanctions be relieved at once, according to Trump. The U.S. was unwilling to do that. Trump says the papers were ready to sign. A signing ceremony was even added to the White House schedule. But then the White House released a statement saying no deal. Not even a joint statement was released, and no framework for moving the talks forward. But some analysts are glad Trump walked away.
North Korea made an untenable ask. They said, we want to partially denuclearize in exchange for a full removal of sanctions.
There are no plans for a third summit, but Trump insists there was no ill will when he walked away.
I think it was very good, very friendly. This wasn't a walk away like you get up and walk out. No, this was very friendly. We shook hands.
Heading into the summit, U.S. officials had hoped at least to agree on what denuclearization means and how to start moving that process forward. 8 months after the first summit, it's not clear they're any closer to that goal. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Hanoi.
VOA's Paris Wong was in Vietnam, and he's back here in Washington and joins us. Welcome.
Hello, Greta.
Okay, so what was it like when you got the word that the signing ceremony was off and the negotiations were done and everyone was going home?
So my first impression was that, crap, I need to get myself ready and run into the press conference right now. A lot of people were very surprised because not just the signing ceremony was canceled, but also the working lunch was also canceled. Now, people were surprised because the day before at the dinner, Kim Jong-un and President Trump seems happy with each other. Even in the same morning at the Metropole Hotel, when they were walking by the poolside, they were laughing, they were joking, they were smiling at the camera, they were answering questions to reporters. So it came with a big surprise for the reporters that how can this fell apart in just a matter of hours?
Well, it seems the Trump administration is putting a little bit of a happy face on this. I mean, they seem, you know, there doesn't seem to be any animosity, but there can't possibly be anything but disappointment because there was a hope to have this big deal and it didn't happen.
So what's interesting was, I think you were there at the Singapore summit last year. So last year they signed a joint agreement or a statement, but that was a very vague statement. That's why before this trip to Hanoi, there was a background briefing in the White House. The senior administrative officials actually told us one of the objectives for this summit in Hanoi is to find a mutual understanding of the definition of denuclearization, because that wasn't defined in the first agreement, even they signed an agreement. So apparently the second one, it wasn't reached that understanding. But for our surprises, we thought since the signing ceremony was already scheduled. We thought something had already been discussed and agreed upon before the summit even happened. That's why we are in Hanoi. But apparently it didn't happen.
Did you get any sense of how Chairman Kim Jong-un's, how he felt or how his staff felt as they left? Were they disappointed or were they thinking that they had stood up to the United States?
So funny thing was that yesterday I saw a news reported by South Korean news agencies that would say Kim Jong-un was actually sick on the way back to Pyongyang. That's why he didn't stop at Beijing, because he was so upset, and that's why he got sick. But my sense was that, because I stayed in Hanoi for two more days after the summit, which was the length of Kim Jong-un staying in Hanoi, he was still out there doing things about, everywhere I go, the road was blocked, and you see Vietnamese people waving the flag, welcoming him or cheering for him. So it seems that he was still enjoying his two more days in Vietnam, visiting there. So we couldn't really tell. But one of the things that also comes with a surprise and rare for the reporters was the day after the summit at midnight, North Korean called a presser at their hotel, at Madia Hotel. And it was the North Korean's foreign minister was briefing the reporters. And that was very rare. And it also shows that they do have something they want to say, which is different from America's account. And apparently there was a huge difference that couldn't be breached. And it turned out to be, has to be President Trump's presser versus North Korean's presser have a different conflict information.
And well, what we hear is that that Kim Jong-un wanted all the sanctions lifted, of course, somewhere by the United Nations, not just the United States, and that was not something that President Trump was willing to do. He couldn't go there. Is there, I guess there's a likelihood of a third summit, but is there any talk of a third summit?
Well, before that President Trump was talking about its possibility, but right now it doesn't seem possible, especially right now North Korea and restarting some of these nuclear projects, and it seems the talk is
Which is alarming. I mean, it shows that sort of what's going on behind the scenes. They go back to their corners and have their tough talk, but they've also restarted rebuilding one of their facilities.
So it might signify that North Korea is actually disappointed when they were leaving, when they left the summit, because they might thinking about I'm already doing enough. Would be what? Pleased. Or honor our first agreement, but apparently you don't think so. So why not just go back to the old way, which I will have a reassurance of the nuclear power that I can protect myself.
Harris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
With more on the Trump-Kim summit and its impact on the Korean Peninsula and the rest of that region, we are joined by VOA's Steve Miller via Skype from Seoul, South Korea. Welcome, Steve. And Steve, what is the reaction to the breakdown of the summit, the talks in South Korea where you are?
Well, initially, the presidential blue house, Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, expressed some disappointment that a deal wasn't reached. Now, earlier this week, he held a National Security Council meeting. And at that meeting, he directed all of his ministers in his cabinet to work together to try and really confirm what is the actual gap between denuclearization ideals between Pyongyang and Washington, and look for ways to narrow the gap. He also instructed his ministers to really look and work hard to try and find a way to bring the two sides together again. And he reiterated his belief that peace on the peninsula and the furtherance of these inter-Korean projects are the gateway to bring about peace and denuclearization with North Korea.
Steve, nonetheless, while this is all going on and being discussed in South Korea, what's going on just down the road in North Korea, well, not just down, but a substantial distance, is they've started rebuilding this missile site again. That must have at least some people in South Korea paying a lot of attention.
When you talk to people on the street, they are surprised that it came out this week, so shortly after the summit. But a lot of people were very skeptical that North Korea would even agree to denuclearization during the summit. If you go back to Kim Jong-un's New Year's Day address and some other statements in state media, North Korea was pretty adamant saying that unless the complete amount of sanctions were lifted and a peace treaty was given to North Korea, they would very quickly resume their nuclear testing and missile testing facilities and their programs. So in the wake of the Hanoi summit not bringing about agreement, some analysts have told us that this is all that unexpected.
It's interesting to watch what's been happening in the lead up to the summit. For the last year, the South Korean president has been, in fact, himself to DPRK, to North Korea. Do you anticipate now that sort of the diplomacy will now shift away from the United States and shift more back to the president of South Korea talking to Kim Jong-un?
Well, President Moon has said very publicly, both in a March 1st address and most recently at a Naval Academy graduation ceremony, that he feels that South Korea's role in propagating peace on the peninsula and bridging the gap between Washington and Pyongyang is now more important than ever. And as I said, he has directed his ministers to look for ways to bring the two sides together.
Well, the United States is, of course, fixated on the issue of nuclear weapons, but facing Seoul on the border between North Korea and South Korea, North Korea has incredible artillery pointing at South Korea. So there's that aspect of it, too, that I assume South Korea is paying attention to.
They are, but you have to also realize that the conventional weapons on the North Korean side pointed at Seoul have been there for quite a long time. And President Moon has been very adamant that the agreement reached in Pyongyang at the third inter-Korean summit that was really more of a military-to-military co-sign doctrine to alleviate tension has been working. So we've seen the removal of guard posts in the DMZ, and we've seen new command and new communications channels set up in the NLL on the western side of the border. So he really believes that open communication and is planning to have more communication with Kim Jong-un to facilitate these open lines of dialogue and hopefully maintain this less tense area here.
Well, I certainly hope he's right, but North Korea has been incredibly unpredictable. And, of course, now with them restarting that missile test site, people are paying close attention to it, even more so than usual. Steve, thank you.
My pleasure.
Ambassador Bill Richardson has firsthand knowledge about North Korea. He has been to North Korea many times, including securing the release of American prisoners and also the remains of American troops missing since the Korean War. Ambassador Richardson has also created the Richardson Center for Global Engagement, promoting peace and dialogue with countries not open to former diplomatic channels. Former U.S. Congressman, Energy Secretary, U.N. Ambassador, and Governor of New Mexico, Bill Richardson is with us from the state capital, Santa Fe. And your resume is practically the whole show when I have to read your resume because you've done so much.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being on your show.
Well, I appreciate joining us. All right, let me first start with this this missile test site that apparently North Korea has started to rebuild. And there's some reports that this was done, this started even maybe before the summit. But your thoughts on it, is it just saber-rattling or is this serious business? They have certainly shot a lot of missiles off over Japan.
Well, it's two things, Greta. One, it's their anger at the summit not ending well, but it's also ratcheting up pressure for future negotiations. This is their traditional negotiating posture. You know, turn up the heat, shoot a missile, visibly show that they're expanding the long-range missile launch site, which is what they're doing. They really did not stop any kind of construction of new facilities, new missiles, new WMD, new nuclear weapons. So this is traditional North Korean negotiating strategy. But even though the summit ended bad and there was a diplomatic setback for both leaders, I don't think it's the end. I think there's an opportunity to move forward under more realistic expectations on both sides.
Well, you compare the failed summit, at least this one, and it's probably an ongoing dialogue, and I'm in favor of an ongoing dialogue, incidentally. But the thing that's sort of on the sidelines to me is the fact that they are in a desperate situation. There's an awful lot of hunger there. They've had poor farming in recent years. People are very hungry there, and they need help from the outside world. So doesn't that sort of ratchet up the pressure on Kim Jong-un?
Yes, and it is a setback for him because his country is one of the poorest on earth. He desperately wants American and foreign investment. He wants sanctions lifted. China is choking him, although they've been lessening some of the sanctions. I wouldn't be surprised, Greta, if the Kim Jong-un doesn't reshuffle his negotiating team. My hope is that the foreign ministry type, the diplomacy types, come back into the negotiations. If you look at his team, it's mainly the spy chief, the intelligence services. They're very hard line. But I think both leaders miscalculated each other. In other words, the staffs were realistic. The staffs knew there were wide gaps on sanctions, on what denuclearization means, on a peace treaty, on all sorts of it, on the sequencing, even a framework of negotiations. But the two leaders talked because thought that because of their personal ties and dynamic that they could come to an agreement. Well, that didn't happen. So it was good that expectations have been lowered. And I think now what should happen is don't do another summit for now. Let the working teams try to define a framework for negotiations. Do smaller things that are important, like remains, like North Korea, South Korea getting together on family reunification, some kind of joint job operations that could be reopened on the DMZ as they did before. Just start slow, but find a way eventually to get to the real, real denuclearization issues, but lower expectations on both sides on what we're ready to do. But well, it's worth continuing.
Well, Kim Jong-un has been a brutal leader. At least he's been accused of killing his half-brother and executing other family members. And President Trump has had sort of softer words for this man. Here's what he said about the Otto Warmbier at least about Otto Warmbier at the State of the Union.
He tells me that he didn't know about it, and I will take him at his word. He felt badly about it. I did speak to him. He felt very badly.
That wasn't at the State of the Union. He said at the State of the Union, he acknowledged the parents. That was obviously the other day in Hanoi. But what about the fact that he doesn't call him out, at least publicly, on some of the brutal stuff that he does?
Well, on the Warmbier case, Greta, my center spent a year trying to get Otto back, and there is absolutely no way that Kim Jong-un did not know. The president gave him a big pass, and he seems to do that with Putin and others, believes what they tell him about certain tragedies like the Saudi issue. So Kim Jong-un knows everything. Otto Warmbier was apprehended by the intelligence service directly under Kim Jong-un. Of course he knew. He is a dictator, no question about it. But he's still, I believe, firmly in control. But his people that saw him on the world stage are probably saying, okay, what about the promises of an economic future for North Korea? We have all these weapons, but what did this summit end up with? So he's under pressure, too, to come up with a strategy of dealing with the United States, which has put him on the world stage.
Well, we only have a few seconds left, but I think the fact that the country is virtually starving, and we've got a huge generation that's been starving, I think is going to put added pressure on Kim Jong-un, but I don't know which way that pressure goes. Does the pressure go to the table and getting rid of the nuclear weapons, or does that, you know, cause him to do something, you know, more serious?
Well, my view is that even though he's starting up his nuclear efforts again, despite these peace talks, he seems to be realistically recognizing that it's best that tensions of the peninsula diminish, that he get investments from South Korea, that he stop threatening Japan, that China take off the sanctions. So I agree with your premise that he desperately needs some economic initiatives to look good to his people and also to get that country out of immense poverty.
Well, when you're trying to save face, it's a bad position to be in. You oftentimes make very unwise decisions, but we'll see what happens. Governor, nice to see you.
Thank you.
In any other week, President Trump's summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would have dominated world headlines. But by now, we are used to seeing a split-screen aspect of the Trump presidency, and news from the summit in Vietnam was forced to compete with another high-stakes political drama taking place half a world away, right here in Washington. The televised public testimony before Congress of Trump's former personal lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, overshadowed the president's diplomatic efforts with North Korea. Here is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
My name is Michael Dean Cohen.
The president's former personal attorney and fixer unleashed on his former boss before Congress and a national television audience.
Because I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist, he is a con man, and he is a cheat.
Cohen accused the president of criminal wrongdoing in connection with hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels and contradicted Trump's previous denials of advanced knowledge of the WikiLeaks dump of stolen Democratic emails. Trump denied Cohen's allegations, and Republicans slammed Cohen as an admitted liar and accused Democrats of using his testimony to set the stage for impeachment.
This is an attempt to injure our president and lay some sort of soft cornerstone for future impeachment proceedings.
But the political and legal damage wrought by Cohen's testimony could be substantial, says legal analyst Randy Zellin.
Michael Cohen is not a good witness, not a great witness. He is the ultimate witness because he was there.
The president saw the hearing as a major distraction from his foreign policy efforts.
But I think having a fake hearing like that and having it in the middle of this very important summit is really a terrible thing.
Beset by weak polls and investigations at home, Trump was hoping for success with North Korea to boost him politically, says David Kim.
Because he wants to win. This is the only diplomatic achievement that he can claim right now. We're pulling out of Syria. We're pulling out of Afghanistan. We have bad relations with our friends in NATO.
The lack of progress in North Korea, combined with the allegations leveled by Cohen, come at a time when the president is preparing for what will be a difficult re-election battle, says John Fortier.
Look, he's still at 43-44% of the public thinking he's doing a good job. That's not a terrible number, but it's probably not a high enough number that he would want to go into the election.
For the president, more challenges lie ahead in the near future, including the long-awaited report summarizing the Russia investigation led by special counsel Robert Mueller.
And Jim Malone is here to give us the latest on the aftermath of President Trump's split-screen week. Jim, nice to see you. Typically, when the president is out of the country, any president, it's sort of hands-off. Was there any legitimate reason why this hearing could have been a day earlier or a day later, so we didn't have that split-screen aspect as the president of the United States is overseas negotiating nuclear weapons?
Well, I think the main answer to that is that we are in a new world now because of the election in 2018. Democrats have control of the House. They can set the schedule, and they can go after the topics and witnesses that they want to talk about. And certainly we're seeing...
So is it politics a little bit? I mean, because I do think that is pretty much of a departure. I mean, even if you hate the other guy, if you hate the president, you know, because you're in the opposing party, is that that's sort of the one sort of thing where you're sort of hands off?
Yeah, although I think that that idea that politics ends at the water's edge has kind of gone out the window for a long time now. I think we're way past that. And I think also what the hearing demonstrated in a way was sort of the double-sided coin that is the Trump presidency. On one hand, he's got this aspirational achievements he wants to go after, but he is being dogged now by investigations at home, and it's not just the one led by the special counsel now. You have an empowered Democratic majority in the House. Numerous committees are now firing off subpoenas and demands for documents.
In fact, they've had, 81 names are on a document demand of virtually everybody who's ever been part of the administration of Trump's life, including former Attorney General. They want documents from him, the CFO of the Trump Organization. It's quite extensive. Any way to sort of measure the impact on the presidency? We're going to have to wait 50 years to find out.
Investigation
stuff.
I think it's a function of the modern presidency, and when you have a split government where one party controls at least part of the Congress and the other party controls the White House, we saw some of this with the Obama presidency. I think right now Democrats are arguing this is part of their oversight, that for 2 years
The first 2 years of the Trump presidency, Republicans controlled both houses of Congress and shirked their duties. This is in the view of Democrats. Now we've got the Trump White House saying this is an unlimited fishing expedition in search of finding a crime. Ultimately, I think, even though there are legal aspects to all of this, this will be fought out politically.
We have a worldwide audience, and they probably are hearing the word impeachment.
Right.
And, you know, define impeachment for us.
Right. Well, it comes from our Constitution. It's rather vaguely defined in the Constitution. It talks about, though, a president could be removed from office for things like treason, bribery, or what's called other high crimes and misdemeanors. It lays out a vague process or rough process for this to happen. The House of Representatives, by a simple majority vote, could vote articles of impeachment, which is the equivalent of a charge or an allegation. So that's one step. And then it would go to the Senate for an actual trial to decide whether the president would be either convicted or acquitted. If the president were to be convicted, the president would be removed from office. Have we ever had this happen? No one's ever been removed from office. We've had two impeachment cases, Andrew Johnson in 1868, and of course, Bill Clinton back in 1999 was acquitted rather easily in the Senate.
Well, you know what's so interesting about, I think, the U.S. government is that we don't give power to presidents. We lend it. We lend it for 4 years, and if the country likes them, they lend them another 4 years of power, but then that's it. So, you know, it's sort of interesting how even Congress can step in, and it has a constitutional right to do an impeachment. Although, is anyone expecting this to go to impeachment?
I don't know. It's too early to say. The Democrats say they're not interested in impeachment right now, at least the leadership. Some of their members would like to be a little more advancing on it. Look at the polls, though. A recent Quinnipiac poll, only 35% favored impeachment, even though they gave the president very low approval numbers and were critical in other ways. And 59% said, no, it's too early, don't go for impeachment right now. So the Democrats have to calibrate that. But I think the thinking is, if they go through their investigations and bring out more evidence or information about the president, they could be in a stronger position down the road to think about impeachment.
We have 20 seconds. Is the president's legislative ambitions over because we have a divided House and Senate, Republican and Democrat?
I think largely so, unless he made a real effort, say, on something like infrastructure to enlist Democrats. But right now, the ferocity on Capitol Hill is so intense, it's hard to see anything getting done in this era of investigation.
It certainly is. It's unbelievable. Anyway, Jim, nice to see you.
Same here.
Before we go, I want to update you on a previous conversation that I had last year with Myanmar's ambassador to the United States. On August 29th, I spoke with Ambassador U Aung Lin right here on Plugged In, and I asked him if he would be willing to accompany me to the Rakhine State in Myanmar to investigate and report on the Rohingya. Here's what he said. Would you accompany me to Rakhine State and show me around?
I would like to.
Because, I mean, I think that's probably one of the best ways to do it.
That
because
would be very good.
I've not been able to get into the Rakhine State.
Sure. Anyway. I will recommend you to visit the Rakhine State. Okay. This is what we have been doing.
The Holocaust Museum, the United Nations, Congress, they've all condemned what has happened in Myanmar as genocide. And we at VOA are determined to report the news firsthand. So I followed up with Ambassador Lin as recently as last week to get an update on the status of his invitation to me. In response, Ambassador Lin sent me a note stating, "We have reported the subject of the proposed visit to Myanmar of VOA plugged-in team to the capital. We have been informed that the officials are unable to facilitate the trip at this time. Nevertheless, we will keep in touch with them on this matter and come back to you when opportunity arises." We urge Ambassador Lin and Myanmar's government to reconsider and allow the world to see what is happening to the Rohingya, allow the news people inside their country. And note, the Reuters reporters who had been investigating mass graves in Myanmar, they remain in prison in Myanmar. That's all the time we have for today. Stay plugged in by liking us on Facebook at Voice America. You can also like my Facebook page at facebook.com/Greta and follow me on Twitter @Greta. Thanks for being plugged in.